one chapter today. We've been doing a couple chapters at a time, and I wanted to do chapters 18, 19, and 20, but as I kept looking at it, I just thought there was too many things to expand on from chapter 18 alone. And so the plan is to just look at Leviticus 18, which is going to deal a lot with sexual sin and God's ethical standards for what that was going to look like for his people. So that's going to be a lot of what we talk about this morning. Can anybody remind us, though, in our culture today, how do people oftentimes think of the book of Leviticus? What have you heard Christians say about the book of Leviticus? Or what have you said about it?
So much that we don't understand. Why?
Yeah, why do we have this? It's really confusing. There's a bunch of details. Details. What else have you...
Boring.
Yeah, it's boring. There's a lot of blood in it. It seems really disconnected from my life today. Even though the book of Leviticus, out of all the books of the Bible, has the most direct speech from God... more chapters and more times where it says the Lord spoke to Moses saying, so on, more direct. If all of God's speech in the Bible were in red letters and not just the Gospels when Jesus speaks, the book of Leviticus would have the most direct speech from God. Even though it's all coming from the Holy Spirit, I get that. But like direct speech from God, Leviticus has the most of it. And it's also probably the most concrete book of the Bible. Like, use this object to do these things. Go into this place. It's not really conceptual. It's very concrete. But the details, we've never seen a tabernacle before. We've never been there. So some of that, is you have to get pictures and ideas in your mind to understand how all of this works. But all of that takes a lot of work and effort. How do you think a Israelite, if when Leviticus was hot off the presses and had just been printed out for everybody to have a copy of it, how do you think an original Israelite would have thought about this book? Because what's happening in the context? How to approach God, and what did God do? What did they do? What did they construct at the end of Exodus? The tabernacle. And at the end of Exodus, God comes into the tabernacle, but who can no longer be in the tabernacle?
Anybody.
Moses and Aaron, they're kind of like, God's glory is so great that they cannot go into this place that God just moved into. That's the end of Exodus. And so the book of Leviticus comes along and says, okay, if you want to be able to commune with him and approach him, this is how you do it. Do you suppose the original audience would have been really excited to get this book? Yeah. They would have been. And Janice has referenced Psalm 100 about this excitement people would have had to be able to come into God's presence. This is an exciting book for the original audience. And it looks forward to how we can commune with God and all these foreshadowings that God gave in the Old Testament. And so the way that the book is structured, the first 17 chapters is showing you how to approach God, and it's through sacrifices. Which, by the way, if you want to commune with anybody or have a deep relationship with anybody, what's required is sacrifice. Sacrificing your time, your talent, your energies, resources, whatever it could be. And so if you want to commune with God, it's going to take sacrifice in the form of animal sacrifices. But these things are teaching them lessons about who God is and who they are in relation to God. So we've seen that in the first 17 chapters, that if you want to approach God, it's only going to be through sacrifices. All of that looks forward to Jesus. Chapters 18 through 27 now is this we've transitioned to this, how do you walk in your daily living now that you're connected with God? There's other books in the Bible that have the same kind of structure, where Romans talks about this is how you approach God, this is how you can have a relationship with him, it's through the sacrifice of Christ now. And then Romans 12 through 16 says this is the practical way that you live in light of that. So you've got the same concept of God's grace being the motivator on why we live the way that we live. You're not saving yourself. Look at God's grace. Even in the Old Covenant, you see all these pictures of it. The Ten Commandments weren't given until the Ten Plagues were given. God delivered them, and then he gave them instructions. And so so you see sort of that same structure going on in the book of Leviticus. It only takes 1 month for them to get these laws. We mentioned that before. But any comments or questions just on the bigger picture of Leviticus, the overall idea of being holy, which we're going to see especially more in these next three chapters? Okay, so just a couple of things to say about this new section that we're entering into from Leviticus 18 through 20, this subsection, is chapter 18 is going to warn the Israelites from imitating the Canaanites. Don't be like them. Chapter 19 is going to give various laws for the people, and a lot of the Ten Commandments are going to be said in different ways, but a lot of them are going to be repeated, especially in chapter 19. And then in chapter 20, he's going to go back to the punishments if you imitate the Canaanites. So you see how these three chapters kind of have an A-B-A pattern to them? So chapter 18 is don't do these things. Chapter 20 is don't do these things, and if you do, here's the punishment. Wedged in the middle of this are a lot of proactive things that you guys need to be doing, like loving your neighbors yourself. There's still a lot of do nots in chapter 19. But does anybody know one of the most common passages from the Old Testament quoted in the New Testament is love your neighbors yourself, which comes from Leviticus 19. Now, one interesting thing about this, and we'll see this as we go through this first chapter, is Leviticus 18, 19, and 20 are going to say constantly, well, not constantly, it's going to say several times, don't do what the Canaanites do. Don't do what the Canaanites do. Don't be like them. But then it says in chapter 19, love your neighbors yourself. Have you ever noticed that before? That in the context where he's saying, be distinct, but still love. That's kind of the imagery of being salt and light. If you want to be the salt of the earth, salt can't preserve something unless it has contact with the meat. But light still maintains a difference and a distinction at the same time. So God is teaching these principles even in the Old Testament here. So don't be like the Canaanites, but still love your neighbor in chapter 19. Kind of an interesting flow of thought. We'll say more about that one in 2 weeks from now, Lord willing, when we look at chapters 19 and 20. Any comments or questions on that? I just want to help us see the overall picture of this subsection. All right. I like using 1 Corinthians 6:20 as kind of a picture of what this chapter is about, where God says you were bought with a price, so glorify God in your body. God has just bought and redeemed the Israelites, and now he's saying, this is what you do with your body. When it comes specifically to intimacy, which is going to be a lot of what this chapter deals with. So, the outline of what we're looking at this morning, the first five verses talk about God's standards versus the standards of the nations. 6 through 23 is going to talk about some particular sexual sins. And then 24 to 30 is going to talk about sickness, God being sick of the people and vomiting the people out of the land. So you can remember this chapter with three S's. You guys have any comments or questions before we start reading from the first section here? All right, let's start out with verses 1 through 5. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt where you lived, and you shall not do as they do in the land of Canaan to which I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You shall follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them. I am the Lord. Okay. Any phrase that you saw repeated a couple times, which by the way is going to be repeated around 50 times throughout the rest of the book of Leviticus? I am the Lord. So he's going to give these instructions and he's going to say, I'm the Lord your God. Tell him to do something. He's going to tell him to do something and then say, I'm the Lord your God. What does the term Lord mean in the ancient world?
Master,
like some kind of royalty. So all threaded throughout all these instructions, he's going to constantly remind them that these laws are coming from a royal authority. This is not suggestion. This is not just advice. This is coming from the king who redeemed you. And so it would be a good thing for us to always remember every time we're reading any passage in the New Testament that's giving instruction. Do we know that it's the Lord our God who's telling us to do this? God explicitly would make that known all the time in these chapters in Leviticus. All right, so what he's going to tell them is to avoid certain things in verse 3. And he's going to tell them to avoid things looking backward and looking forward. So in their past, they had been in Egypt. Do we know if they were influenced by Egyptian idolatry? What's the evidence in Scripture that they were?
Golden calf.
The golden calf?
Stephen's speech.
Yeah, good, Stephen. Well, what does Stephen say again?
About the idols that they had in the wilderness. Carried the star god, Moloch.
Yeah, and then Amos chapter 5 brings, I think, some of those same things up as well, that they carried some of these things with them in the wilderness, as it were. They're still sacrificing to goat demons in chapter 17. I wonder if they learned that from the Egyptians. So, they've been in Egypt. It's debatable. I personally think they were in Egypt for 215 years, not 430. But they had been in Egypt for some time. And in that time period, I think they had been steeped in the idolatry of the land. And so they're leaving, and they've got to get those things out of their hearts. But then, looking forward, they're going into Canaan, and there's going to be temptations that they're not even aware of that are going to be there. But why in either situation would they fall prey to the idolatry of Egypt or Canaan? What would be the motivator for that?
Sexual license?
Yeah, there's moral... these people were more lax morally. God's standards are much higher. He says, don't be like them. Don't be like them. Do we ever want to be like everybody else? Like the peer pressure that comes with this. This is a problem for them. We'll say more about this as we go through this. But you see that you've got these both directions. Don't do what you did in the past. There's going to be challenges in the future. Is that true for us, by the way? Are there things that we've done in the past that could really hinder us? And are things in the future that we might not even know? But the idea being that we've always got to be guarded against sin. Any comments or questions just on that idea?
Well,
yeah, Janice?
It just occurred to me that they should have. Could have, because they made a powerful choice in the right direction, because every one of the plagues involved something that the Egyptians worshipped.
Yeah.
And so they had great illustrations of what God's all about, such things.
Right.
But it didn't impress them deeply enough, I guess.
And this is what Exodus 12:12 says, that when God does the final plague, he's going to bring judgment on all the gods of the land. Which is what he's been doing, but it's like the final death blow now. Jewelry, isn't it?
I was just thinking about it at present time, when you have a church that's made up of people who come from many different places.
Yeah.
Many times they bring in ideas of what they had experienced in the past, and it complicates the unity that you're trying to achieve.
Right.
On the other hand, sometimes people who come from very conservative areas, when they come into a place like New York, we saw that, they tend to liberalize and become like the people around them.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the problems even with preachers moving up there is that at times they become more liberal in their thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, you're influenced by your surroundings. All of us are. Yeah. And it's how much are we able to fight that, things like that. He tells them, do not walk in their statutes. Don't do it. I started reading parts of the Code of Hammurabi two nights ago, and some of them are pretty similar to what Moses writes about, and some of them are very different. They had more laws in the Code of Hammurabi about mutilation, like if a son like strikes his father, that the son's hand would be cut off, but like in the Old Testament, in God's standards, like the kid would actually be killed if you dishonor your mother and father. So there's some similarities and some differences. The idea here, you shall not walk in their statutes. You're going to expect them, and this is not the people from Hammurabi, these are different people, but they're going to have very different laws than what God's laws are. And when people say that the Old Testament copied from the laws of the other nations around you, you've got testimony within the scriptures that God is not doing that. He's saying he's giving them something very different from what everybody else had, which means this is helpful for us, that whenever you see weird laws in the book of Leviticus, it is a reaction, not a bad reaction. It's a reaction to what those people were doing and saying, you do not do those things. The example that I like to bring up, how many of you have gotten really angry and said, I could just boil a goat in its mother's milk today? Anybody ever got like bad traffic? I just need to boil a goat right now in its mother's milk. Well, why would that be a temptation? Why would that ever have to be instructed to the people? Which I think that law is brought up three times in the Pentateuch. Because that's what everybody else did. And so it's like today, imagine that you had a concerned parent with a teenage kid, a couple teenage kids or whatever, and the concerned parent writes a letter to the kid saying, be aware of, what would a parent say today? The internet, Instagram, social media, what else? What would be some of the modern things somebody might write? Okay, yeah, the friends. Maybe don't go to that school or something. I don't know. And like, you, let's say you cryogenically froze that list of things that the mom was really concerned about, and then 2,000 years later, you open that capsule and you're like, "What is the internet? And what is Instagram? And what?" You see what I'm saying? That every culture has got ways of manifesting sin that you have to react against and not be influenced by. So a lot of the weird laws in Leviticus are proper reactions to what other people were doing. In fact, I like this passage in Deuteronomy 4, verse 6, where God is telling the people about his laws, keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. God's laws, his ethical standards in the Old Testament, are a high step above what everybody else was doing. And if they live these things out, people would go, whoa, what's different about you? That same thing is true for us today. Okay, anything you guys want to say about this instruction? Yeah, Terry?
If the Israelites kept those laws grudgingly, like, I can't believe we have to do, or I can't believe we can't do that, it would not give that impact upon the nations around them.
Yes, very good. What's our attitude towards fulfilling what the Lord our God tells us? The Lord our God who saved us from something worse than Egypt? We should do this joyfully. Ruth?
I think that what you said reminded me of John 13, where it says, by this all will know that you are my disciples.
Yep.
If you have love for them.
Yep. Yes, very good. But there's something about us doing what God has asked us to do, individually and corporately, that sends a message to the world. Good. In the midst of, like, okay, don't look backwards, don't look forwards. Well, where do I look? He says in verses 4 and 5 that you do what God has asked you to do. His statutes serve as this unchanging guide. 50 years ago, did people have different ethical standards in the United States that have changed now? What if you're just kind of going along with what society? Well, you're going to contradict yourself every 25 years. And so what's going to be the thing that just keeps you firm and fixed and stable and not moving and all that? Just don't go with the moral trends of the day. Just go with what God says. And he says if you do this, you'll live by these laws. Now, there's a couple ways to read what he means by this in verse 5. If a person does them, he shall live by them. Some people think that this means, I'm not going to get into all the New Covenant ideas of how this verse is used in Galatians, but I think the idea being that if you obey, you're not going to be judged and kicked out of the land, which is what, and killed, like physically killed, which is what Leviticus 18 ends by talking about. If you guys do what I say, you will live long in the land. But this idea of live can also mean your quality of living, like Jesus saying that he came to give an abundant life, that he's about to give them some examples of his moral standards. If you do them, you will know what real life is. And you might be tempted to look at what all the Canaanites are doing, and you might remember what you used to do in Egypt, and you might think that that was abundant life, but it wasn't. You forget the slavery, and you forget all the other things that are accompanying these things that look enjoyable in the moment. True life is found in the restrictions that God gives us. Alright. Any thoughts or comments on any of that? Alright, so that's kind of like the preamble for what he's going to start saying about some specific examples of his ethical standards. One of them, which is what this chapter largely talks about, is sexual sin. So, the outline of this, verses 6 through 18 talks about sexual sin that can happen within families. And then 19 through 23 talks about sexual sin that can happen outside of the close family relationships. And so that will be the two sections that we see here. One of the phrases that you're going to see 15 times in this chapter is uncovering nakedness. How do we say it in the South? Naked? Is that what it is? I don't know. That's what I've been told. So uncover nakedness. What does that mean? Does anybody know the first time in the Bible that a phrase kind of like this is used? But it's not exactly the same phrase? Noah. So with Noah, his nakedness was exposed, and Ham saw his father's nakedness. And so there it seems like he looked upon his dad's body and kind of made fun of it or something like that. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 26, the priests are not supposed to have some kind of altar that they step up onto because of their robes. If you could see underneath, you'd see their nakedness. So in both of these passages, these ideas mean that you don't expose your body. But it seems like this phrase means something more than that in Leviticus 18, because look at verse 6. None of you shall approach any one of his close relatives to uncover nakedness. So this idea of approaching and uncovering seems to be like a euphemism for intercourse. So that's what I think that this phrase means in this chapter. So he's going to go through all these different laws. Let me suggest that these laws, largely in chapter 18, are written from the perspective of men. Men, don't do this, don't do this. Because who are largely the perpetrators of sexual abuse? Mainly men. Now, does it happen with women? Yes, it can, but mainly it's men.
Sometimes when women are trying to be like men.
When women are trying to be like men, it happens? Yes, yeah. A corrupted man, yes. But there's one example where a woman is explicitly told to not do something in verse 23 with regards to bestiality. That's the only one applied specifically to women in this chapter. But men would oftentimes be the aggressor in this situation. And so what these restrictions are going to do, can you imagine how these would protect women within the theocracy that is the nation of Israel? So it's showing that women are not mere objects for men. By the way, even today, sexual violations oftentimes occur within close family situations.
More often, probably, than we realize.
It's, I think, a lot more often than and I've known of too many cases of that happening. Here he's going to give these really revolutionary kind of laws, because the Egyptians would oftentimes marry the brother, sister, things like this. And here he's going to have a higher standard that shows, like, this, the closest you can marry, I forgot to figure it all out, but I think the closest you can marry is like a first or second cousin or something like that. I'm going to have a chart that you could probably deduce the right answer from. Okay, but one idea from this is that your desires and your passions, sensuality, all of these things are expected by God to be submitted to His will. This is, I think, one of the most offensive teachings in Scripture today. That people will say, my body, my choice, I get to do whatever I want to do with my body. And then God says, no, I bought your body. And you have to subject it to what I say. And so the Bible seems very culturally regressive when it talks about sex ethics and things of this nature. There's a lot of things that we could say about this. But I like verse 5, God's plan for these things, I think, is what leads to real life. People that don't follow these kinds of things that we're about to look at, I think, would end up with a lot of pain and turmoil in their life. Okay, anything you guys want to say just about introducing this concept that he's going to deal with here? Okay, so here's a chart. It's kind of in order and kind of not, because I tried to group it under general groupings here. So here's the prohibitions with close relatives. So he's going to bring up mothers, which would obviously mean biological mother, but in what scenario would that ever, you know, it's almost like you'd say, well, obviously not your biological mom. When would it be more tempting in this culture, I guess?
Stepmother,
was polygamy a thing? Yeah, so like, you could imagine that might be, well, and you have examples of this.
1 Corinthians 5.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 5, the man with his father's wife. Now, I have right here instances of violations of these things. The ones that are in green are the ones that take place before the law of Moses was given. The ones that are in black are the ones after the law of Moses was given. And so for mothers, okay, the law is biological mother, no, stepmother, no, aunts, whether it's paternal or maternal. Sisters, obviously not biological sisters, stepsister, paternal sister. Look at verse 18. This is an interesting one. You shall not take a woman as a rival wife to her sister, uncovering her nakedness while her sister is still alive. What is he saying here? Don't marry who?
Sister-in-law.
Don't marry your sister-in-law. And what does it say will occur in verse 18? What is the term for the new wife?
Rival.
rival wife. Can you think of any stories in the Bible where that happened and there was a lot of rivalries? Yeah, Rachel and Leah. So you kind of like look back and go, oh yeah, it makes sense. We'll say more about that verse in just a moment. Daughters, biological daughters. So you got all these examples of, okay, within this circle, no. God's laws say absolutely not. Any thoughts or comments just on this chart here? Oh, one of the things I want to bring up. So if you read some what some people say about this chapter, and you read some like what skeptics say about this chapter, one of the things that seems ominously missing is your biological daughter. It doesn't mention the biological daughter. So some people said, well, this just means that the Israelites wanted that as an excuse that they could do that or whatever. But look at verse 6. None of you shall approach any one of his close relatives to uncover nakedness, I am the Lord. So you've got close relatives just broadly, and then he's going to give a lot of examples of it. But go over to Leviticus 21, verse 2, and see how within this overall context, close relatives is defined. And start in verse 1 of Leviticus 21. And the Lord said to Moses, speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, no one shall make himself unclean for the dead among his people except for his close relatives, his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother. Talking about touching a dead body. But here he defines close relative as including your daughter. So I think contextually you can make all those points. Okay. Anything you guys want to say about this chart here or what God's standards are in general? I want to make a couple observations from this. Yeah, Teresa?
I have a question. You remember when Noah was
with Ham,
and his son saw his nakedness.
Yep.
And so he cursed him for doing that.
Yep.
I mean, how does that? Why do you think he did? I mean, how does that all play into that?
Okay, so some people have suggested, and that goes to where was that? Right here, the uncovering nakedness here. That you can see that in Genesis 9, and this is why Ham's descendants are cursed and things like this. Some people say that what Ham did, and the text doesn't say it, but it kind of euphemistically tells you what happened, that he committed sodomy. I don't think that's what's happening. The text doesn't use the same phrase, uncover nakedness. It says that he saw his nakedness, so I don't think sodomy is happening here. But I think it's like he saw his dad's nakedness and kind of made sport of it or something like that, disrespected him. And the other sons, like, in contrast, they're walking backwards to cover their dad. So it seems like the thing is, like, you don't gaze on the nakedness of your parent. Like that, and that's what Ham did. So, but it doesn't use the exact phrase, uncover nakedness. It uses some of these words, but not together like this chapter does. So I don't think that that's the same thing. Yeah, but that's a good question, though. Okay, so let's just make a couple observations from what he says about the close relative thing. I think it's interesting that the Bible records violations of these laws. That why would you make up these stories? If you were going to make up Judaism, why would you have these law codes and then have like some of the heroes of the Bible seemingly breaking these things? Why would you include that if you were going to try to make up something? So I see that as something that goes in favor of evidence for the Bible. The Bible is constantly showing you the flaws of his people. So I think that's an interesting observation to make. Also, close relatives includes those that you're connected with through marriage. So you might not be biologically tied to them, but you've got stepmother or an additional wife in verse 8 that your father has through polygamy. That through marriage, it's considered a close relative. You have an aunt by marriage, you've got daughters or a sister-in-law in verses 15 and 16, that the marriage, the act of marriage puts you into another family of which there are limitations. So marriage has that kind of connectivity to the people that you marry into. And that's one of God's ethics that I don't think was followed in other places in the ancient world. So that's an interesting thing to see there. You also have the implication of one flesh here. Look at verse 7. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, which seems like, you know, sodomy or something like that. But he goes on to say, which is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness. So your mother's nakedness or stepmother's nakedness is equated with what? Your father's. Because they are one flesh. And so to defile your mother-in-law or your stepmother would be like tantamount to defiling your father. So you've got that implication given there. So I think that's interesting to point that out. And then also some things to say about the rival wife. Do you guys have different translations in verse 18? Do some translations indicate that the rival wife is not the sister of the woman you're married to, but it's just any time polygamy would happen? Anybody have a different translation?
Well, the center note in the New American Standard says, let's see, let me get the right part. You shall not marry, take a wife, would be the center note. A woman in addition to her sister, and that could be another.
Yeah, so the debate is, does sister constitute biological sister, or does sister mean sister Israelite? In the context, it seems like biological sister, because he's talking about close relatives and things like that. So that makes better sense. So I think that this is applying, you know, a man marrying a woman and then also that woman's sister. But does this principle of rival wife get applied to situations that are not exactly that way, but they're still polygamy? Like, I think about in 1 Samuel 1 with Hannah, he has the two wives. Elkanah has two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. And it says in 1 Samuel, I think it's 1:6, that she was the rival. She was a rival wife. So every time, when I took my Bible as literature class in college, I had to write a research paper on the Bible. And my research paper was on why you should be able to deduce that polygamy is wrong, not from any laws in the Bible, but just from the examples of polygamy. And so I did this paper. I wish I still had it. I don't know where it went. But I just looked at the examples of polygamy and just said, like, the way that the Bible portrays this relationship is very negative. And so it's really hard to justify that it's okay just because you see it happening. So
when I was in Nigeria, as many of my stories began, there were several churches that still tolerated polygamists in the church. And I was invited to a group of them once to speak on polygamy. And that's the very approach I took. Wow. I talked about the complications that developed when there was polygamy in the Bible, and those old men were sitting there nodding because they were experiencing the same kind of consequences that those biblical people had experienced.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. That's funny. Terry?
It's interesting to me that in all of these cases, when these laws are violated, there's always trouble. And not necessarily God sending down thunderbolts or anything. There's just trouble.
Right.
There's dissension. You think of Abram and Sarah and Hagar and how Hagar gets sent out twice into the wilderness and the heartbreak of Abram sending away Ishmael. You think of the trouble that's caused with Amnon and Tamar. Every single time these laws are violated, either explicitly or from experience, we can see the heartbreak and the trouble. God's laws are for our good, always.
And that's I think verse 5 again, the one who does them will live by them. You'll know what real life is if you just submit yourself to what God says. So I think you can look at the general principle of verse 18. Does it apply to sisters? Yeah, but this is a strong law against the whole concept of polygamy. Genesis 2, you know, talks about God's plan for marriage there as well. So, okay, good. Anything else you guys want to say up through the close relative thing? Yeah.
This isn't really to do with the close relative or whatever, but way back up at the top where you were talking about the Bible candidly shows the flaws of God's people.
Yeah.
Kind of as an evidence of the Bible. It also, I don't know about those examples that you had, if every one of those applies, you know, you could see it exactly. It shows the flaws of God's people to show the redemption offered by God.
Yes.
You know, that's even a greater one. It might be a story to show how somebody really messed up. Isn't that sad?
Right.
The Bible goes on to say, but it doesn't have to, the story does not end.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So like when people, like one of the things that my mom always says is, how come David is a man after God's own heart, but look what he did.
Yeah.
Well, have you ever done anything wicked? Aren't you kind of glad that story's there? Like, kind of gives us hope. Like, look at Hebrews 11 and all the people that God looked at as faithful that we would look at as being not faithful or whatever.
Faithful not because he did a lot of good things.
Right.
Faithful because God said, but you're precious to me and I'll pay for that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, good. And I will say, one of these concepts, the concept of polygamy, is Jesus a polygamist? I mean, so the church is one, right? Like, it's a multitude of people, but it's we're one in Christ. Do you think Jesus ever looks down from heaven and goes, you know, sometimes I really want those Muslims. Maybe I'll just be able to marry them, too. Like, maybe they won't have to change. I'll just take the Muslims, too. And those Hindus, I'll take the Hindus, too. Like, how many people today have a polygamous view of God? That these people can be his, and those people can be his. He's got one bride, and he's not going to cheat on us. So, Teresa, do you have a...
I had a question. Just a question. So, when, you know, some of these laws, it seems like, can be bent for the better of the person. Example, if the brother's brother died, then it's the older brother, whoever's responsibility.
The liberate marriage? Yeah, so some of these laws apply only while the person's alive. Yeah, and I think verse 18 says that, right? Well, her sister is still alive in verse 18, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah, Sherry?
I think in England for a long time there was a rule that if you were married and your wife died, you could not marry her sister. Because that was just one of the laws that they had based on this, and they changed it, I think, after World War I.
Interesting.
Because so many men were killed. And
so like same kind of concept as levirate marriage.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Interesting. Let's look at then this other section about sexual sin outside of close relatives. There's going to be this instruction about not worshiping Molech, kind of just seemingly random in this. So as we read this, try to think, how does this instruction for Molech fit the context? Look at verses 19 to 23. You shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness while she is in her menstrual uncleanness, and you shall not lie sexually with your neighbor's wife, and so make yourself unclean with her. You shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. And you shall not lie with any animal, and so make yourself unclean with it. Neither shall any woman give herself to an animal to lie with it. It is a perversion. Okay, a couple examples here. We'll go through some of these quickly. First one, no relations during menstrual uncleanness. And of course, you might be wondering, what did he say in chapter 15 about that? You're unclean, and you have to wash, and the man is unclean for 7 days. So how can he have this outright, like, this is wrong here, but then in 15 seem to give allowance for it?
Well, doesn't it involve the preciousness in God's sight of blood?
Yeah, I think that's... But how come in chapter 15 he seems to say that you're unclean for a few days, but here he says you can't do it? So my resolution to this, and I hadn't thought about this when we looked at chapter 15, was that maybe the earlier mention is for an accidental occurrence of that. But if you know, then it is you can't do that. So maybe that's what's going on there. Neighbor's wife, anyone that's not your spouse, you got homosexuality in verse 22. I think there's about 6 references to homosexuality in the Bible. You've got this one in verse 22, Genesis 19, Leviticus 20, Romans 1, 1 Corinthians 6, and 1 Timothy 1. Now, you've got 6 passages in the Bible that condemn this. And does anybody know what the New Age interpretation of these verses are? The thing you never knew. Anybody know what it is? What was that?
Violence.
Yeah, this is talking about some form of rape or something like that. That this is talking about not like consensual. But look over at chapter 20, verse 13. Chapter 20, verse 13. If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood is upon them. So the death penalty, the penalty for this is death. Let me just, I'm just going to point this out. Don't assume that Christians will always know that this is sinful. Do you suppose that people in my generation, in the next 5 or 10, and maybe even right now, maybe they wouldn't want to say it out loud in a church building like this, because there's all those old people that would think that I'm wrong about this, but they don't realize how awakened I've been. But this is actually not wrong. Do you suppose that there's people that probably come here every Sunday that have that mindset? No. Yeah, Janice?
Society is just brainwashing people. If you listen to media or the shows they produce and all that kind of stuff,
yeah,
it's just being accepted as okay.
Yeah.
It's a part of life.
Yes. Now, why do you... Yeah, so you got the cultural brainwashing. Can you think of any other ideas why people in my generation would start to say, oh, this is actually not that big of a deal?
If it goes on in their family.
Yeah, there's a family member. Good. Like, actually, one of the reasons Samantha's mom, a grandma, after she became a Christian, fell away is because in Samantha's family, there's several people that fit this category. And so, like, there's the family tension that this brings can be one example. I think another one is, you know, I met one, and they're really nice. Which can be convincing if all you've ever heard in church is, that's wrong, and the tenor that you've heard is, those people are wicked, 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 and you've got this imagery of wicked as being, like, a really mean-spirited person, and then you finally meet one, and you're like, they're actually really nice. Like, what are you talking about wickedness? And so I think some of it needs to be, like the discernment in how we talk about it, that can there be a lot of people that are really nice in this world that are wicked because God's standards are different than our intuitions about things and stuff like this. Yeah, like, we've got to learn how to talk about this, not in a blanket kind of way. In a blanket way, it's wrong. And there's never a justification for it. But how we talk about it maybe sometimes alienates people that struggle with the sin, that are Christians, and are trying to learn how to fight it. And maybe for other people, they get this imagery in their mind that when they finally go to college or they meet somebody in their high school that is living this way, you go, this is not what I heard growing up, because they're nice people. So how we talk about it can affect some of this, Dan.
Plus, when people see all them marching, they say, how could all them people be wrong?
Yeah, good. You see the numbers. Like, could God really say that all of them are just wrong for everything that they're doing? Good. And obviously, like, we just had Pride Month. It's like every company, like, I like pocket knives. Swiss Army made a rainbow knife, and it's supposed to be like a manly knife thing. Like, what is going on with this? But it's like all over the place.
And many of them are not that in your face kind of thing that marches in these parades.
Yes. Yeah. Good. Teresa, did you have something?
You remember the I think the golf player, I forgot his name, Bruce, I think. But I can't remember, Bruce Jenner or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe he didn't play golf. I don't know.
He was a runner.
Oh, okay. So he was doing an interview the other day on TV, and he specifically was explaining how he made the decision to start his transformation.
Uh-huh.
And he said after he had discussed it with his wife, then they discussed it with the children, he said something interesting. He said, then I wanted to discuss it with God. So he went to his preacher, and he asked his preacher, was he doing was right? Was it the right thing to do?
Yeah.
But from all appearances of the interview, the preacher gave him the go-ahead. So he took that as a confirmation from God that what he's doing is right. And then his last statement was, I pray I go to heaven.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, let me... Yeah, Stanton.
I think some of the media we consume, which has subtle ways of influencing how we perceive, you know, homosexual characters that are being portrayed.
Right.
And us becoming more sympathetic towards them.
Which Joe Biden did a... I'm gonna bring up a couple people, not because I'm making any political points at all. This is not my point. But Joe Biden, in I think 2014, had an interview where he talked about Will and Grace, the TV show that portrayed gay people in a really positive light. And he said that Will and Grace has done a lot to progress these ethics, to like normalize these things in our society. But Donald Trump was the first president, Republican president to win, that was pro-homosexuality. Like, when Obama ran, he was against it. Do you guys remember that? And then Trump, when he was running, he was like, it doesn't matter, whatever people want to do, that's fine. So when I bring this up, not to get images in our mind of people we like or don't like or whatever, the reason that I bring this up is that even in conservative America, which has traditionally been against it, there's more of an acceptance of it, which is going to make all Christians that care about what God says look more like dinosaurs in our culture. Because even conservatives are becoming more and more okay with this. It's becoming more normalized. And so, yeah, Terry.
That is even more reason for us to keep our behavior in other areas above reproach.
Yes.
So I think there was a county clerk that refused to give a marriage license to a homosexual couple, and they were like, well, you gave it to adulterers, you gave it to people that were in second, third marriages. But the point is, if we start saying homosexuality is bad, but they say, but you cheated on your income tax, or you
right.
stole supplies from the office, or something like that, then that completely knocks out any validity that you have in their eyes.
Right.
So it's
and in this text, look at where homosexuality is in the context of heterosexual sexual sin and things like this. Now, does any of that mean, so it's really not that big of a deal? No, that's not what any of this means. But that's, so, and the last thing he brings up here is bestiality with this, with animals, which is common in some countries and in some cultures. Okay, anything else you guys want to say about, I guess?
And there's no reason in the world in this country that that should be unlawful if other things are lawful.
That's right, yeah, that's a good point. That if we're okay with homosexuality, which is, we're going towards pedophilia in our society, trying to normalize that.
All of those things are beyond the laws that
right.
we have a right to make.
Yeah. So I remember when I was like in junior high and people were debating homosexuality, and it was, people would always say, why are you so concerned about what people do in the confines of their own house? Do you feel like that's not really what the concern has ever been for this movement? That it's like, if you don't accept us now and you don't agree with us, you are a bigot and we need to silence you. Do you see that there's, like, when it comes to worldly philosophies and worldly ways of thinking, there's never satisfaction with any kind of laws that are passed. It's like, this law gets passed, but there's more work to do. This law gets passed, and there's more work to do. It's not going to stop. It's going to keep going towards pedophilia. It's going to go towards bestiality. Like, this is where it devolves. This is what Romans 1 talks about. Homosexuality, by the way, is like a big cultural thing. When that culture accepts that you know it's really going downhill now. That's part of the point of Romans 1. So is there something qualitatively different about homosexuality to heterosexual sin? Yeah, one of them actually is sort of within the design of what God said. I'm not saying that one makes you more condemned than the other, but there is something that Romans 1 says about the downturn of a nation, that when they start accepting these things, it really is a terrible sign. Any sin is, but you see what I'm saying. But of course, we're all dinosaurs. Now in this context, in verse 21, he has this warning against worshiping Molech. So here's my question. How does this fit the context? You've got sexual sin, sexual sin, sexual sin, Molech, sexual sin.
But be treating your children as an object, which is what sexual sin is also.
Yes, disregard for human life. Did Molech have temple prostitutes too? Maybe there's some connection to that. You've got the disregard for human life. Maybe another example is that the offering of children is an example of wasting seed, which is what these other examples were as well. Not stewarding seed, you know what I mean? Those could be some things to think about with that. But let me point this out. Okay, Molech worship today. Do people worship Molech today?
In a sort of different way.
Yeah, what did Molech promise if you worshipped him?
Prosperity.
Prosperity, you're going to have financial peace. Okay, why do people get abortions? They don't want the financial burden, right? And so there's some financial benefit to doing this. You can see that example. But, and this is maybe another one of those times, but like, so you got homosexuality, you've got the concepts of abortion here. These are really hot topic things that I think sometimes in the past, the way that Christians have articulated these things have not been helpful. There's people in my family that have had abortions. And I know to this day that they're on antidepressants because of that. And so, can you be forgiven? Yes, every sin can be forgiven. So it's not one of those things that you just plop out there and go, and it's wrong. Well, yeah, but it can be forgiven too. And so you've got that going on. But are there any more subtle ways that Christians can worship Molech without ever having an abortion?
Yeah, about prosperity becoming your God. I mean, about your finances and your time and your energy.
Yeah, and what is it that you're instilling in your kids? Like, you got to be successful. If the only conversation parents are having is this political person or that political, or politics, you're giving your kids to the altar of politics or sports. We're going to miss church services for sports or just general success. I've seen some parents push education so much that, like, they're not having their kids get ready for Bible classes ever. And I've said this before, and I hope my pride never gets to me in this regard, but when my kids are growing up, I do not care if they go to college or not. In fact, a lot of colleges today are doing more to destroy people's faith than not. I don't care if they go to college. I don't care if Asher's a dump truck driver or he's a janitor, as long as he's a Christian. I do not care. And if Christians start to push these things so much, to the point where their kids maybe are really successful or whatever, what have you gained? Pride that you can say that your kid's got a six-figure... Well, whatever. Whoop-de-doo. That doesn't matter.
Your child's been sacrificed.
Your child's been sacrificed for Molech. So, any comments or questions on that?
I think of the song, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul?
Yeah. Yep. Anything else you guys want to comment on with that? A lot of that is powder keg issues, but I think we're all on the same page with some of this stuff. Okay, look at the end of this chapter then. Look at verses 24. By the way, I'm not against college. I went to college. If Asher wants to go to college, we will have lots of conversations about how he will discern what he's learning.
If it's a situation that can help you serve the Lord, fine.
Yeah.
If it's in any way hindrance to serving the Lord, it's bad, matter what the result might be.
And I think about Daniel in Daniel chapter 1. What is it that the culture is trying to strip away? Your name, your identity. Daniel, like, what does that mean? God is my judge or whatever. You're going to be whatever the other name is, which has pagan gods associated. So we're changing your identity. Like, you shouldn't be that. But we're also going to teach you our things. And then it's like a lot of people voluntarily do this by going to colleges today and stuff like that. I probably sound like I'm more against college than I'm for it. I am for it. I'm okay with it. But if you don't go into it with discernment, you're going to be eaten alive. Yeah.
Well, what you were saying, like, the road we're going down, in how many years will he be in college? It could be a lot worse.
Right. And maybe not even financially worth it anymore.
Right. I'm just saying, you have to look at it as the years go by.
Right. Yeah, like when I went, like, there was obviously a lot of immorality. I had a lot of opportunities to teach people the gospel. And so, like, that was cool. But then there's other colleges that do have biblical kind of emphasis and stuff like that, so that's cool too. So there's options. But just if you're not discerning, then you're going to fall into the same trap that Leviticus 18 talks about. So look at the end of this chapter. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, for by all these things I am driving out before you. By all these things the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean, and the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you shall keep my statutes and my rules, and do none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. For the people of the land who were before you did all these abominations, so that the land became unclean, lest the land vomit you out when you make it unclean, as it vomited out the nation that was before you. For everyone who does any of these abominations, the person who does them shall be cut off from among all their people. So keep my charge never to practice any of these abominable customs that were practiced before you, and never make yourselves unclean by them. I'm the Lord your God. Okay, so he talks first of all about what's going to happen, but he talks about it in the past tense, like it as if it's good. It's as good as already having happened. The judgment on the Canaanites. So he says that they became unclean through their iniquities and abominations. Had God waited for them to become this bad?
Yeah.
In Genesis 15:16, God telling Abraham, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. By the way, when I said earlier that I think that the Israelites were in Egypt for 215 years and not 430 years, this is one of the reasons why. He says to Abraham here, they'll come back in the fourth generation. 400 years later, from Genesis 15. And so that's just one part of the puzzle, but when you look at what Galatians is saying and this passage here, like, you put it together, I don't think that you can It's harder to make the case that they were in Egypt for 430 years, but that's not the point of what we're talking about right now. Anyways, so here's one thing that I bring up to skeptics when I study with them. One of the books of the Bible that's really offensive is Joshua, where they're doing the conquest. How could God be all into ethnic cleansing and genocidal maniism and all this kind of stuff? Here's the thing that I'd like to bring up to skeptics. That if you were neighbors to the Canaanites and you observed what the Canaanites did and they were never judged, you'd be wringing your hands and going, where is the God of justice? How come he does nothing about the wickedness in the world? And as soon as he does something about it through the vehicle of the Israelites, you complain about that too. That when you know what these people were doing, I think everybody would say that it would stand to reason that they ought to be judged. But here's one of the points that I think is really critical to make here. God is holding Gentiles accountable in the Old Testament who do not have the law of Moses. He's using terms like they were unclean through their iniquities and through their abominations. In the Old Testament, God holds Gentile nations accountable. Amos chapter 1, he condemns 6 Gentile nations in Amos 1 and 2. And then also, the book of Nahum is about the city of Nineveh, 100 years, 120 years after Jonah preached to them and they have repented. So God is holding these people accountable even in the Old Testament. And as the nations disconnected more and more from God, then it was right for God to judge them. And so that's an important thing to see there. And you're going to see that here that they're going to be vomited out of the land because these nations made God sick. So, would God judge nations today who didn't ever have his law, they're not actually a theocracy? God has always been fighting against sin, not against ethnicities. Because he's about to warn the Israelites that if they go into sin, they're going to be judged as well. So the conquest of Joshua shows this happening. Sometimes for judgment, God will use nature, like floods and earthquakes, and that seems to be more okay than when God actually uses other people, like the Israelites. But each of them are forms of how God exercises his judgment. Okay, so that's what's going to happen to the Canaanites, which serves as a cautionary tale for the Israelites, because they could become unclean like them. He says in verse 30, don't be like them. Don't become unclean. Up to this point in Leviticus, what is the term unclean meant? How has it been used?
Ceremonially
unclean, which we've said repeatedly is not inherently sinful. Now that picture is used within Leviticus to say, this is kind of like you guys can become unclean in the sense that you have become sinful. And so what happens if they're going to become unclean as a nation? What will God do with them? He'll vomit them out of the land too. So he's not into favoring one ethnicity or another. He's always fighting against sin. But being unclean prevents you from being in God's presence. That's applied to the temple in Leviticus 11 through 15. And it ultimately gets applied when they do get vomited out of the land in 2 Kings 17, where 3 times the text says that they were carried away from the presence of the Lord. Away from the presence of the Lord. 3 times it says that in 2 Kings 17. And I think it's 2 Kings 25 says it as well when Babylon did it to the southern kingdom. But this idea of uncleanness means you can't be in God's presence. The temple thing in Leviticus 11 through 15 is kind of like a living parable to teach them if they become unclean through their sin, they will be vomited out of the land. So you see kind of the buildup of how this uncleanness concept is being used in Leviticus. Any thoughts or comments on that?
It's interesting. We just did this in our kids' class, and it's interesting because, you know, at the end of the Judges, when they said, we want a king, against the king, we want to be like other nations, and then 2 Kings 17 says, why did this happen to you? Because you became like other nations.
That's right, yes. It brings up the same kind of idea.
That's exactly what they...
Yeah, they're not learning from these laws. Like, be distinct, be different. So the idea being that they could be, and they will be, vomited out. By the way, in the Old Testament, there's 3 sins that specifically make the land unclean or defile the land. Sexual sin, in this context, murder in Numbers 35, and then idolatry, Leviticus 19, and then Jeremiah 16 say some things about that. Okay, so we've already brought up that this shows that God's not an ethnic cleanser. One final thing here. This is not like the big point to end on, but it's just interesting to point this out. In verse 26, God wants the sojourner to submit to his law as well. He's there. So, like, All right, Santee, are you a full United States citizen? But do we expect Santee to obey our laws in the United States? Yes. Good job, Santee. So for the sojourner in the Old Testament, like they're maybe temporary residents or they're traveling through or something like that. The nation of Israel was a theocracy. You'd expect people that were traveling through to obey the laws. And so as people would travel through and maybe they would do what God said, maybe they'd get a taste for God's better ways to live and things like this. But this is one of the ways that I think the nation of Israel was intended to bless people around them, that when you come here, you submit to our laws, and maybe you'll experience something that you hadn't experienced before. I don't know if that's part of the reason. But either way, the temporary resident in obeying these laws would not influence God's people to become wicked. So, all right, so that is Leviticus 18. I'm glad that we didn't try to do 19 and 20. Any other final comments or thoughts on any of this? We'll say more about this idea of being influenced by the world, but this is not a novel temptation. It has existed. It was why Israel was sent out of into exile. But I think we need to be discerning how are Christians today being influenced by our culture? I mean, we've all been influenced in neutral ways. Like, it's okay to drive a car. That's just a neutral thing. But that's part of our society and our culture. What clothing is made out of, that's a cultural thing. But, like, I'm thinking ideologies. Like, what are the ideas that are being pumped into news media, into social media? Like, what are the things that people are believing that when you really stop and discern them, are totally contrary to what God says? But how many Christians are being poisoned by these things, a slow death, being slow cooked into these things? We've got to be careful about this. So, all right, that is Leviticus 18. Let's go ahead and pray, and then we'll be done for today. Gracious Lord, we thank you so much that you've given us so many helpful instructions in the Bible, that you've ultimately shown us your Son Jesus, who perfectly obeyed all of these things, that by his righteousness we can be saved, and though we have so many flaws and faults in our hearts, that our salvation comes not from our perfection that we attain, but from the things that you've done for us. We pray that we would appreciate that you are the Lord our God, that the nations around us or the ideas around us and the sins around us are not the Lord our God, but you are. Help us to have the fortitude and the strength to be willing to lose friendships, to be maligned, to suffer, as we try to hold what you have asked us to do and we try to honor you with the loyalty that you deserve. We thank you so much for this time together, and it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.